Allegations of sexual misconduct against film producer Harvey Weinstein sparked the Me Too movement and exposed the true extent to which our legal and judicial systems continue to let down victims of sexual harassment, bullying, discrimination, and other unsavoury behaviour. Crimes such as rape, domestic abuse, and sexual assault are known to disproportionately affect women. As prosecution rates continue to fall, it's increasingly clear that the system is not only silencing, but ultimately failing women. I'm Ruth Green, multimedia journalist at the IBA, and I'm speaking to senior content editor Meg Lewis and content editor Jennifer Sadler-Venice. We discuss how the justice system is failing to protect victims of sexual crimes and what ways we can strengthen the justice system to level the legal playing field. Jennifer and Meg, thank you very much for joining me here today.
Hello.
Thank you.
So you've both been writing a lot on this area for the IBA website, and I know we've got a lot to discuss today. I think I'll start with you first, Meg. What have you discovered about how women are being let down by the justice system?
Well, 2019 was an eventful year for women in the justice system. In discussing various stories that we kept coming across, Jen and I both agreed there was a convergence of issues that appeared to be symptoms of the same sort of problem. That is, our justice system just doesn't seem to be set up to support vulnerable women. And so we decided to investigate why. And we began by looking at a judicial review challenge that was launched against the Crown Prosecution Service in June of 2019. The CPS is the principal public agency for conducting criminal prosecutions in England and Wales, and a letter before action was sent to the CPS by the End Violence Against Women Coalition, and then in September, the coalition launched a judicial review challenge against the CPS. The coalition, which is being represented by the Centre for Women's Justice, alleges that the CPS has secretly adopted a policy of dropping perceived weak rape cases or changed its decision-making practice in order to boost prosecution success rates. We spoke to Harriet Wistrich, the director of the Centre for Women's Justice. She told us that if they were to be successful in the case against the CPS, it would show systemic failures may amount to human rights violations. So the case centres around the fact that in 2018, the CPS removed reference to the merits-based approach in rape investigations from its legal guidance. The coalition claimed it was a covert strategy to abandon cases that the CPS considered having a lower chance of conviction.
Oh, I see. And can you tell us a bit about this merit-based approach? What did it involve?
So the merits-based approach stressed the need to consider the seeking as well as the giving of consent, including if the individual was in a fit state to give consent. So, for example, prosecutors would need to consider any manipulative behaviour by the defendant in the lead-up to the incident, and campaigners argue that it's really vital that prosecutors consider these nuances around consent when looking at cases of sexual violence.
Yes, and we know that there are issues with the definitions around consent, not just in the UK, but in many different countries. Jennifer, in your reporting, does it seem that consent-based definitions that we have are enough, or does more need to be done?
More definitely needs to be done, but legislatively and in terms of the public's awareness of the law as well. So in the UK, we have a consent-based definition of rape, which factors in a person's freedom and capacity to consent and the ability to withdraw consent at any time during sexual activity or each time sexual activity occurs. But a lot of the UK's population have a different view of what constitutes rape. In December 2018, the End Violence Against Women Coalition published a report following a survey on public attitudes to consent. Many people in the UK don't think it's rape if the woman flirted with the man on a date and then changed her mind before or during sex, and almost a quarter of the respondents thought it isn't generally rape if it occurs in a long-term relationship. 1 in 10 respondents were unsure or think it's usually not rape to have sex with a woman who is asleep or too drunk to consent, so that relates to the UK's language on the capacity to give consent. And finally, a third of people in Britain think it isn't usually rape if a woman is pressured into having sex, but there is no physical violence.
So that's the situation in the UK. What about the rest of Europe?
The Council of Europe's 2014 Istanbul Convention, which is about preventing and combating violence against women and domestic violence, defines rape in terms of consent and asserts that consent must be voluntarily given. But 23 of the states that ratified the convention don't have legal definitions of rape that are in line with it. Most European definitions actually rely on evidence of violence or intimidation of the victim for sexual violence to be considered rape, like so-called coercion by force. Only 8 European jurisdictions have a consent-based definition, according to Amnesty International analysis from late 2018. We have seen some progress. Sweden and Iceland both introduced amendments changing their definitions of rape to consent-based in the spring of 2018. But Iceland's amendment received criticism because it is unclear on whether consent can be withdrawn during intercourse, which obviously has a huge impact on our understanding of rape, And this and other criticisms highlighted the lack of nuance in Iceland's law. So that's where I think we need to do more in introducing nuanced laws and obviously making the public, at least in the UK, much more aware of the nuances. Sweden went further, and I think this is a very interesting model because, as well as the new definition, Sweden introduced two new negligence-based offences called negligent rape and negligent sexual assault to account for cases where there should have been an awareness of the risk that the other person was not participating voluntarily. In a recent case that used the new legislation, the Swedish Supreme Court said, a person who is subjected to sexual acts against their will does not have any responsibility to say no or express their reluctance in any other way. So it's on the person instigating the sexual act to check for consent. Now, rights organisations have said that Sweden's new law was crucial in 7 cases, including 6 convictions of negligent rape. So having a broader consent-based definition that encompasses these kinds of nuances is really important. And if the UK has had a mechanism for ensuring consent was sought since 2004, but has potentially lost that merits-based approach, then, as you can see in Sweden, that could mean a huge impact on rape cases here.
Yes, absolutely. And it does sound like there has been progress in Sweden. But if we're looking at the UK, Meg, what has been the impact then of some of these developments?
Well, the Centre for Women's Justice says it's gathered 21 cases where decisions have been made not to charge, despite compelling evidence that there has been rape. Part of that claim is that the CPS is second-guessing jury prejudices in order to boost conviction rates. And a lot of that is tied up with what people understand by consent, as Jen has just explained. An October investigation by the Law Society Gazette upheld the Coalition's allegations when it revealed that the CPS did have hidden internal targets to bring conviction rates up to around 60%. The CPS has since acknowledged that this may have provided a perverse incentive to drop perceived weak cases in order to hit those targets, as prosecutors could be criticised by inspectors if they missed that target.
Right, OK. So basically what you're saying is that conviction rates at least appear to have got better, primarily because fewer cases are actually making it to court.
So the easiest way to put it into perspective is that if you prosecute 8 cases and win 4 of them, then your conviction rate is 50%, right? But if you prosecute 6 cases and win 4 of them, your conviction rate shoots up to 66%. So you can see how actually dropping perceived weak rape cases, where the CPS decides the jury may have certain biases against the claimant and therefore don't have a strong case of reaching a conviction, then dropping those cases entirely before they ever get to court means that they can boost their conviction rates.
Yes, absolutely. And aside from the issue of conviction rates, we also know that despite movements like Me Too and Time's Up, we're actually seeing fewer cases of rape being reported, severely underreported. Why is this? Meg, do you have a feeling for what's happened?
You're absolutely right. National UK statistics have shown a vast drop in rape convictions over the past years, despite the amount of women coming forward actually being on the increase. The number of reported rapes across 2018 and 2019 increased by 173%. That's just under 58,000 reports of rape. And yet just 1 in 71 cases resulted in a charge or summons across this period. That's the lowest number on record. In 2015, just 3 years earlier, the number of cases resulting in a charge or summons was 1 in 7. So these sorts of statistics really are doing nothing to encourage women to come forward.
Yeah, I agree. And we also have anecdotal evidence that if a case goes to court, the trial process itself might be re-traumatising victims, and maybe that's something that's putting people off. Mm. We have to think about everything that a person would have to consider sacrificing in order to take something like this forward. Lots of information about themselves, their personal life, their sexual history and things like that, that can be brought up by the police in the first instance and then in court during a cross-examination. And I think one of the scariest aspects of that is that the complainant in a rape trial gets no legal support whatsoever. They are on their own. In 2018, there was a case known as the Belfast Rape Trial. 4 high-profile rugby players were found not guilty of gang raping a woman. During the trial, each of the accused had his own lawyer, and the complainant faced brutal cross-examination by all 4 lawyers over 8 days. She had her internal injuries disputed in court, and because the public were able to attend and see her face, she actually had her identity revealed on social media. That case raised serious concern globally over the treatment of all parties and prompted reviews of how rape trials are conducted in both Ireland and Northern Ireland. Northern Ireland's review, which was conducted by Sir John Gillan, a former Lord Justice of Appeal, was published in May 2019. The report contained 16 key recommendations, including one about legal representation for the complainant from the outset of the case and up to but not including the trial. There's also a recommendation for a more robust judicial attitude and case management approach to prevent improper cross-examination about previous sexual history. And Gillen recommends early pre-recorded cross-examination, initially of children and vulnerable adults, to be conducted away from the court, with that being rolled out to all complainants of serious sexual offence cases with time.
And what about in the UK? If cross-examination is such a deterrent to victims reporting, have we seen any moves to improve the situation, Meg?
We have. Look, there is an understanding from the judiciary that cross-examination may be re-traumatising for complainants. In England and Wales, victims of sexual violence can already give their police statements on video and therefore potentially avoid having to appear in court. And Scotland is currently undergoing a pilot of the same initiative. And then there's a long-delayed pilot scheme that finally launched in June 2019 in some courts across England and Wales, which meant that rape complainants could also pre-record cross-examination evidence in advance of the trial too. And when the scheme was first announced in 2017, then Justice Secretary Liz Truss said it would allow judges to stop inappropriate cross-examination. So that means any reference to a complainant's sexual history, for example. It could be edited from the video before it was seen by a jury. That's really important because a judge could say, look, scrap that from the records if that examination was taking place in front of a jury, but it doesn't mean that it hasn't already influenced the jury's opinion. So it's a really, really important development. And the pilot is trying to tackle those biases that can cause juries to sway one way or another in their decision.
Yes, and there's also been some controversy over the new digital disclosure form, hasn't there, Meg?
Yeah, and that's another reason that women may be dropping out of the process. The new National Digital Disclosure Form rolled out in 2019 has been covered widely in the press because of the implications it has on rape prosecutions, specifically women dropping out. So basically, women coming forward with allegations of rape are being asked to disclose their digital records. This can be your phone, it can be your laptop. In one jurisdiction, it was reported that a woman was even asked to disclose her counselling records. So it's not only an incredibly intrusive process from the complainant's point of view, but also from the state's perspective, this is an enormous amount of data to be sifting through. It can run to tens of thousands of pages of data, and state authorities simply don't have capacity. And when we approached the CPS about the allegations made of their changing their policy, they pointed to an increase in the volume of digital data and the analysis of evidence gathered by following reasonable lines of inquiry as one of the reasons for those falling charge rates. And the CPS Inspectorate released an extensive study on 17th of December 2019 as part of an emergency end-to-end rape review commissioned in light of these allegations. The Inspectorate also pointed to a lack of resources, specifically a lack of funding for police and prosecutors, saying that in 39% of rape cases, prosecutors had sent out requests for digital information not proportionate to the investigation. The Inspectorate didn't find the CPS to have changed their strategy, as the Coalition alleges, but campaigners are questioning the independence of that review.
This is really concerning in the sort of wider context of what's happening in the UK. For example, in England and Wales, we know the judicial system is struggling. So the fact that they're introducing initiatives that are seemingly adding further burdens to the system doesn't seem to be a great policy. We're having courts that are having to close down up and down the country. We've got a number of sitting days are being dramatically reduced, let alone legal aid cuts as well. And that's clearly meaning that there are fewer people that are able to get their claims to court because they simply can't afford to do it by themselves. Mm. We obviously need legislation, we need investment, and we need better trial processes. What do you think, Jennifer, in terms of the way that we can move forward to try and help women pursue these kinds of cases?
We need to look wider than the justice system, and we actually need a societal shift on how we view violence against women. So as Meg talked about rape myths and the cross-examination, the jury hearing things that might sway them in the wrong direction, one of Gillen's recommendations is for measures at the outset of a trial to combat rape myths, such as written judicial directions. And that's really important because the survey results, obviously I mentioned earlier, indicate the public making up the juries in these cases may have beliefs about consent that don't align with the law. And I think a lot of that comes down to how we view sex and sexual violence against women in society. If you get wolf whistled at in the street, people still say that you should take that as a compliment, even though it's actually street harassment. So that becomes something you deal with in your everyday life. You normalise it. You normalise harassment, you normalise abuse, and you end up normalising violence against women. However, when misogyny like that is taken seriously, it does make a real difference. So Meg and I also looked at a trial done by the Nottinghamshire Police, where they recorded incidents of misogyny, including violence, as hate crimes or hate incidents. So wolf whistling would have been classed as a hate incident because it's not already a crime. Many more women came forward because they had faith that they would be listened to and taken seriously, because violence and verbal harassment weren't being normalised anymore. Wolf whistling wasn't something that you should ignore. It was a hate incident directed at you because you're a woman. The trial of recording incidents in that way is over now, but things like that, changing the way we understand how women are treated, I think is a societal shift that we need to happen for real progress to be made here, including legislatively.
Yes, and I think we've also seen elsewhere in Europe, for instance, in France, they've started issuing on-the-spot fines following new legislation there that tackles street harassment. So that's been an interesting development. Then in England and Wales, we've had the upskirting ban, and I know that Germany is also considering bringing in similar legislation. And to me, this points to wider recognition that everyday sexual harassment is just something that won't be tolerated anymore. But clearly, we haven't seen as much progress in other areas. Meg, I think the domestic abuse bill is just one example, isn't it?
Yeah, and it's a prime example. The bill was making significant progress through the parliamentary system when it was dropped in the proroguing of Parliament last September. So for a bit of context, in January 2019, the UK government published a landmark draft domestic abuse bill. It provided the first statutory definition of domestic abuse in England and Wales. So alongside instances of physical violence, the new definition recognised psychological coercion and financial control as abusive behaviours. And I think when we talk about domestic abuse, there's often a stereotype that it's purely physical violence. So to insert these new definitions really shows an understanding of domestic violence as a very broad spectrum. People such as Sally Challen, their lives have been changed because of this understanding. Sally Challen was convicted to 18 years in prison in 2011 for the murder of her husband, Richard. Her appeal centred on the fact that coercive control became a criminal offence in England and Wales in 2015. So there was a lack of understanding of coercive control as a form of domestic abuse when she was first sentenced. At the hearing in the summer of 2019, Challen admitted that she did kill her husband, but she denied murder and cited diminished responsibility following 40 years of alleged psychological control and coercion. So she was eventually sentenced to time served and was freed from prison. And more recently, we've seen the case of Faricia Martin be granted the right to appeal her murder conviction for similar reasons. The Court of Appeal permitted the challenge after hearing that Martin was a repeated victim of domestic abuse, including psychological coercion. In both cases, the women speak of years of sexual, physical and verbal abuse, with almost every aspect of their lives being controlled by their partner, from who they spoke to when they could leave the house. So the domestic abuse bill was trying to incorporate a wider understanding of domestic abuse and how it can be executed by perpetrators, as well as proposing provisions that would bolster the rights and resources for victims of domestic abuse who came forward. It is important to mention, though, that lots of women's groups came forward to say the legislation didn't go far enough. They claimed that the needs for specific vulnerable groups of women were being left out of the bill. A vulnerable group they pointed to were migrant women who they say would risk being taken to an immigration offender if they came to the authorities seeking help. So when the bill was going through pre-legislative scrutiny, we spoke to Penny East, who's the head of communications at domestic abuse charity Safe Lives. And she told us that we really need to keep the pressure on to make sure that not only does the bill survive any Brexit distractions, but also that it goes far enough and is ambitious enough. Sadly, now we know that the bill didn't survive and it has to go back to the beginning of the process. And while that is disheartening, it does mean that groups can continue to push for wider provisions to be included when the bill is next discussed in Parliament, whenever that is.
Yes, and it could potentially lead to a more positive outcome. And this could be true for other proposed pieces of legislation here in England and Wales, which didn't even get as far as the domestic abuse bill did. We've seen a call, for instance, for better regulation and legislation surrounding non-disclosure agreements following the Harvey Weinstein and other high-profile scandals, where wealthy individuals have allegedly used gagging orders to silence victims of sexual crimes. There's been a big push even within the government itself from the House of Commons Women's and Equality Select Committee to bring in greater protections in this area. The government pledged to do this. They haven't delivered on this yet, but we'll see maybe if the legislation comes to fruition in 2020. And so as we draw this conversation to a close, it seems in one sense that there's still a lot of progress that still needs to be made. Jennifer, do you think that the cases we've discussed have raised a greater awareness of the challenges facing women in the justice system?
Yes, and I think we can take positively the sign that awareness raising, particularly through protest as well, can make a difference legislatively. The Belfast trial was very concerning in terms of the treatment of all parties, but the outcry that came afterwards means the response has been to make sure those concerns are addressed as soon as possible. Legislators are actually waking up and taking notice. Generally, I think the hashtag MeToo movement has made a huge difference to how we view women and therefore how we view sexual violence against women. Although it's super frustrating that the onus is on women to be pushing for change in the face of all of these setbacks, I think we'll see more progress in these areas if we keep up that momentum. We need to keep speaking up about how the justice system could work better for women. We need to be putting pressure on politicians and legislators to redefine consent globally, which, you know, it would be helpful if they could all ratify and properly incorporate the Istanbul Convention that I mentioned earlier. And essentially, they need to make eliminating violence against women a priority.
And Meg, how are you feeling about the prospects for 2020?
Quietly hopeful, I suppose. We know the law isn't a speedy process. We've seen pushes for change in 2019 affected by political manoeuvres, whether that was budget cuts, whether it was Brexit wranglings or other agendas. And in the meantime, vulnerable women are left unprotected in the system. So with a new government in place, hopefully we'll see some momentum pick up in Parliament. But with the Brexit transition needing to be finalised by the end of 2020, we could see these issues pushed to the back of the priority list again.
Yes, and certainly one of the things that really struck me when I last interviewed Zelda Perkins, the former assistant to Harvey Weinstein, was that she was still really concerned about the potential pushback against all this progress that we've seen since Me Too and Time's Up. And really, without better regulation and legislation, she said there would always be people who would try and find ways to work around the system. And so for me, I think it's clear that in 2020, we really need robust legislation, robust regulation and processes across the piece to ensure that the justice system is not doing women a disservice.